We examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. If you're not listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network, then your radio is not on.
Africa Live.
Welcome to Africa Live here on the WhoRadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we've got a great show lined up for you today. We're going to be talking a little later on about the growing anti-Muslim sentiment all across the U.S. We'll talk a bit about what's going on in Haiti now. We'll talk about a number of other things that are happening in the world. What we're going to do right now, though, is we're going to take a little break. Well, we're going to play a little music for you, better yet. And then when we get back, we're going to jump right into the program. So stick with us here on Africa Live on WhoRadio.com. Thank you. Earlier this week, police in Mozambique opened fire on crowds of demonstrators as they protested rising prices in food, fuel, and water. The demonstrations turned out crowds of thousands on Wednesday, September 1st, in the capital, Maputo. One witness, Horacio Antonio, said he saw police fire on the crowds without provocation. The police attacks were brutal, with at least 7 people killed and many more injured. The lifeless body of a 12-year-old boy lied in the Maputo streets. Another child, a 6-year-old girl, was gunned down by police as she tried to get home from school. Unrest in Mozambique is anticipated to continue, as the crisis does. The price of bread has risen in Mozambique by 25% in the past year, and according to the UN, international food prices have risen to their highest in 2 years. One protester, 34-year-old Albino Mkwate, stated, "This strike is about the hike in prices. More than that, it's about injustice." Over the past month, it has been revealed that Africans from Somalia had become a target inside the U.S. by the federal government, as the U.S. continues to wage an unjust proxy war in Somalia to steal the oil there. On August 6, charges against 14 people were revealed by the U.S. federal government, with all the charges relating to providing support to militants in Somalia. Despite these charges being framed as terrorism charges, what they actually amount to is providing support to forces opposing the U.S.-imposed chaos in Somalia. Since 2004, the U.S. has had a regime installed in Somalia that controls very little territory in the capital of Mogadishu. Although it has been supported militarily by the U.S., both directly and indirectly at times. The installation of this regime is part of a long-standing effort by the U.S. to take control of Somalia and exploit the valley of oil that lies underneath it. In 2006, in an effort to solidify this regime it was imposing, the U.S. government militarily pushed out the Islamic Courts Union, which was recognized by many in Somalia as the legitimate government. To help with this military assault on Somalia, the U.S. government used the military participation of its neo-colonial regime in Ethiopia. Even today, a military assault using Ethiopian troops continues on Somalia to attempt to strengthen the U.S.-supported group in Mogadishu. Those arrested recently in the U.S. are accused of supporting forces opposed to the illegitimate U.S.-imposed force in Somalia. 2 women among the arrested are accused of having gone door-to-door taking up donations for forces opposing the assault on Somalia. In other news, U.S. President Barack Hussein Obama declared an end to the U.S. combat mission in Iraq on Tuesday. However, the troop withdrawals ended with 50,000 troops still occupying Iraq. Along with those troops were left armed civilian mercenary contractors to continue to carry out the terror imposed on the Iraqi people since the start of this most recent U.S. war in occupation of Iraq in March 2003. Despite it having been revealed to the world that the pretext of a presence of weapons of mass destruction used by the Bush regime to invade Iraq was completely false, Obama's regime continued to carry out this war once coming into power. This occupation has come at the expense of at least 1 million Iraqi lives and the displacement of at least 1 million more. BAC Coalition for Peace, Social Justice, and Reparations has responded to this end of combat mission with continued combat troop occupation, with a call to end the occupation. The group, which held the first mass demonstration in opposition to the Obama regime's continued wars against oppressed peoples on November 7, 2009, is set to hold another national march on Washington on November 13th of this year, around the anniversary of its first march. That rally is being held under the slogan, "Stop U.S. Imperialist Wars, Victory to the Oppressed Peoples in the U.S. and Throughout the World." Stay tuned to uhururadio.com for more information on that. Now we break for the rest of the program here on Africa Live on uhururadio.com.
To earn, and every us from Africa. We was once happiness pursuers. Now we backstabbing, combative and abusive. The African and Arab are at it, they most Muslim. We should be moving in unison, disputes are in. Bounty hunters in Grape Street get cool again. Substandard housing, got the young runner rampant, wildin'. Poor phantom, he can stallin'. Mass on his face, grabbing his Ruger. Say nobody move, I shoot you, man, you expiring. Cause 25 and he does it like a man inside with black, white pride and Mexican. Survive the best he can, strap a shake to his thigh. Why don't we all collide? Why do the young die? Extortion, murder, and burglary. Tattoos his chest says his enemies don't deserve to breathe. Everyone deserves to burn, and every child deserves to learn. Cause every man deserves a turn, like Babylon deserves to burn. I drink poison, then I vomit diamonds. I gave you Mandela, black Dalai Lamas. I gave you music, you enthusing my kindness. So how dare you reduce me to Donny Imus. Timeless in case we ain't never been acquainted. Flyness, we made it, it gets duplicated. Mindless violence, well let me try to paint it. Here's the five steps and most to explain it. One. It's me and my nation against the world. Two. Then me and my clan against the nation. Three. Then me and my fam against the clan. Four. Then me and my brother with no hesitation. Go against the fam until they cave in. Five. Now who's left in this deadly equation? That's right, it's me against my brother. Then we point a Kleshnikov and kill one another. Everyone deserves to earn, and every child deserves to learn. Every man deserves a turn, like Babylon deserves to burn. On our tribal, over colors, over money, over land and over island, over God and over idols and evil lovers. Over breakfast, over dinner, over sofas, over jungle, over Rima, over bookers, over Brooklyn, over Queens and over rockers, over red and over blue and over chokers, over red and over blue and undercovers. Tribal trouble, the tribe is double. Cause the youth them now go a war and go fight with knuckle. The two-side scuffle, Vietnam now go a war with no more kung fu, none chuckle. The silent shuckle, and the Queen of England and Uncle Sam them a flex them muscle. The tribal hustle, blood time and puddle, survival struggle. Everyone deserves to earn, every child deserves to learn. Each and every one deserves a turn, like a flame deserves to burn. Everyone deserves to earn, and every child deserves to learn.
Tune into Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 a.m. on the Uhuru Radio Network. We examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. If you're not listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network, then your radio is not on.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution. Uhuru, and welcome back to Africa Live here on UhuruRadio.com. We're just listening to Tribes at War, which is a song by Nas and Damian Marley off their Distant Relatives album, featuring Kanan. And before the little news segment we did, you were listening to Mandrill's Lord of the Golden Baboon. I want to go back into the program at this point. And speak to an issue that we've been seeing around the U.S., across the U.S. We've seen anti-Muslim sentiments really blowing up. It's anticipated that on September 11th, which is coming up soon, and is the anniversary of the 2001 attacks that resulted in the destruction of the World Trade Center and a gaping hole in the side of the Pentagon. It's anticipated that white nationalist violence against Muslims will likely happen. There are Muslim organizations around the U.S. that are preparing to, for this possible likelihood. It's we've seen a lot of this stuff really heating up. One particular lightning rod for a lot of these anti-Muslim attacks. Has been this question of the proposed building of an Islamic cultural center a few blocks away from the site of the World Trade Center. It's really become a lightning rod for this anti-Muslim debate. Despite what some, would have us believe, it's not something that's isolated just to New York or isolated to this question of this Islamic cultural center being built close to the World Trade Center. In fact, you hear people, opponents of it, in the news say, things like, well, it's just bad taste, if they built it somewhere else, it wouldn't be a problem. But the reality is that all across the U.S., very far away from the site of the World Trade Center situation is all these, anti-Muslim attacks, these anti-Muslim, this growing anti-Muslim sentiment, really, across the U.S. I mean, we see it all over the place. In Gainesville, Florida, there's a church that's called the Dove World Outreach Center that is going to burn copies of the Quran on the anniversary on September 11th. This church, is calling on people to come down and fellowship with them and burn Qurans. This is a Christian church, and it actually reminds me of something that Malcolm X said some time ago about an African being lynched and calling on God to help him, and at the same time the lynch mob is calling on God as they lynch you. But it's something that is firing up all across the U.S. I mean, you see that in Gainesville, Florida. But you also see, like I said, all across the U.S., mosques are under attack. Mosques in places like Tennessee and California are being hit with protests and vandalism. Even in Western New York, shotgun a fire was fired during two nights of harassment of a mosque in a small town in Western New York. I mean, it's all over the place. In Phoenix, Arizona, there's a mosque there, or an Islamic community center there, where recently, vandals broke into the building and threw paint all over the floor and broke up windows and tore up the place. And of course, Phoenix is in Arizona, where this general debate around not just Muslims but immigration in general aimed in particular there at Mexican people, where the governor there, has put forward, laws that would make it illegal for that really set up for Mexican people to be under attack. Just legalizes really what police already do, and a lot of them intensify that in terms of their attack on Mexican people there. Of course, while Governor Jan Brewer, I'm sure some people saw this recently, where the governor there, Jan Brewer, you know, is putting forward all this, you know, anti-Mexican stuff. She's, you know, they put forward this stuff, you know, saying you need to be able to speak English to come into the country and all this stuff, but she can barely form a sentence. If you look at a debate that television spot that she did recently there, where she couldn't even have speak right. But anyway, just back to the real question is, you know, there's really this anti, it's not just anti-Muslim, it's anti-African, it's anti-Mexican, but you really see leading up to this September 11th anniversary, this anti-Muslim expression really booming. You know, there are these lynch mobs that are really popular lynch mobs that are really being formed. And white individual white folks are, you know, carrying out attacks. I mean, you looking back at New York, at the site of the building of this Islamic Cultural Center there, you know, well, first of all, I mean, when you look at this question, it's ridiculous. I mean, you have a constitution here in the U.S. that says that people supposed to have freedom of religion, and says a number of other things. People supposed to have freedom of speech and all these other things. Of course, when it really comes down to it, those freedoms ain't there for Africans and Mexicans and Arabs, and you know, you don't have that really there. It's just a piece of paper. In fact, you know, Africans, we ought to be able to relate, because, you know, you see all the time, where, you know, you say the wrong thing and you liable to get jacked up by the police, you know, forget your freedom of speech. But, you know, going back into New York, you have at the site of the building of the Islamic Cultural Center, you had recently where white demonstrators almost attacked this brother who's a construction worker working in the area, you know, and they thought that he looked like he might have been a Muslim. And so they got ready to attack him and really, you know, started going at him. But there's also the case of this taxi driver in New York who was recently stabbed by this white nationalist named Michael Enright. Who stabbed the guy inside of his taxi cab for being a Muslim. And, you know, I want to play a clip from the news on that. I think this story and how they handling it is extremely, extremely interesting, you know. So I'm going to play a news clip. This is from ABC on the stabbing of the taxi cab driver in New York.
This is Eyewitness News at 11. This is Eyewitness News at 11.
He stabbed me. Then I'm trying to hold him and I'm telling him, please do not kill me. I'm very hard work. I work very hard.
Asked if he was Muslim, he said yes. Then his attacker started slashing him with a knife. Tonight, he tells us his terrifying story. Good evening. I'm Sade Bedarinwal. Liz is off.
And I'm Bill Ritter. Tonight, a crime that is horrifying people around the country and many Muslims here in New York as well. Ahmad Sharif, driving a cab for 15 years in New York City, rushed to the hospital today with several serious slash wounds, including one on his neck that could have killed him. We're going to begin our coverage tonight with Eyewitness News reporter Jim Dolan. He's in the Kips Bay section.
This is Eyewitness News at 11.
He stabbed me. Then I'm trying to hold him and I'm telling him, please do not kill me. I'm very hard work. I work very hard.
Asked if he was Muslim, he said yes. Then his attacker started slashing him with a knife. Tonight, he tells us his terrifying story.
Good evening. I'm Shade Bedarinwar. Liz is off.
And I'm Bill Ritter. Tonight, a crime that is horrifying people around the country and many Muslims here in New York as well. Ahmad Sharif, driving a cab for 15 years in New York City, rushed to the hospital today with several serious slash wounds, including one on his neck that could have killed him. We're going to begin our coverage tonight with Eyewitness News reporter Jim Dolan. He's in the Kips Bay section of Manhattan where the attack happened. Jim?
Bill, Ahmad Sharif had just started his shift. He picked up his first passenger right here at 24th and 2nd. And at first, the passenger seemed pleasant enough. And then he asked Sharif if he was Muslim. And when Sharif said yes, everything changed. The passenger started mocking Islam, mocking the month of Ramadan. And then the passenger pulled out a knife.
He started yelling at like 39 Street and 3rd Avenue. This is a checkpoint. This is checkpoint, motherfucker. I have to put you down.
Ahmad Sharif was trying to figure out what the man in the back of his cab was screaming about when suddenly the passenger started attacking him with a knife, stabbed in the arm, slashed across the throat, again in the face.
No doubt in your mind, though, he wanted to kill you. He intended to kill you.
Yeah. So when I move like this, then he's trying to get my throat and I'm trying to hold his hand.
But his attacker was younger and stronger and relentless.
So much anger, and he hate me. He feel good if he can kill me. He says, over there, forget it, I'm dead.
But he wasn't dead. As Sharif fought off his attacker, the man gave up and escaped. Bleeding and weak, Sharif called 911, and a nearby officer quickly arrested 21-year-old Michael Enright of Brewster in Putnam County. He was charged with attempted murder and a bias attack. Police said he appeared extremely intoxicated.
Most people is nice.
Sharif said he doesn't understand the rage and hatred of his attacker. He said he moved to New York, raised his family in New York because of the diversity it provides.
This is the city for all color, all race, all religion, and we are all together. I don't know what his why he get this one. I mean, which forced him to do this to me.
Uhuru, that was just a clip from ABC on the stabbing, the recent stabbing of a taxi cab driver in New York, in Manhattan, because he, you know, was a Muslim. This white man gets into the back of his cab, named Michael Enright, who, you know, asks him if he's a Muslim. And at that point, begins to stab the man, just, you know, attempts to kill him, you know. And the thing, that is interesting in this particular case is how the media is excusing this guy, Michael Enright. They humanize him, you know, something completely opposite from what they do to Africans or anybody else when they when they arrest us, you know, it's a different kind of way that the media deals with an African or the way that they deal with a white person, you know, because this guy, you know, all you hear on this is how, you know, how they don't understand how he did it. He must have been so drunk. He was such a lovely person. You know, and even the way they describe him, you know, they describe him as, you know, film student Michael Enright, you know. But this guy, you know, he's a killer. He's an attempted killer, you know, who attempted to take this man away from his family just because he was a Muslim. You know, but the media excuses him. In fact, they talk about all these stories. They bring out people who tell you how great of a guy he was and how you know he loved diversity and all these types of things, but you know it's a different type of way that the media is dealing with this guy and this real vicious attack, and that's vicious. You know, to attempt to stab somebody to death is a vicious kind of attack. You know, an interesting thing in this is that this guy was in Afghanistan. This guy was in Afghanistan, and if you heard Ahmed Sharif, the victim in this case, you know, he said that Enright, who stabbed him, was yelling, "This is a checkpoint. This is a checkpoint, MF. I gotta put you down." You know, so this guy again was in Afghanistan with U.S. troops there, and I think you know, looking at this, you have to look at the fact that in Afghanistan you have, you know, this military force the U.S. has there that is committing all kinds of terroristic acts against Arabs, against Muslims there. You know, in the midst of an unjust war against the people there, you know, and I think that gives context to this thing. It's part of this white nationalist fervor that's being drummed up in the U.S. And I wanna take a break here, and we wanna come back, and we're gonna have some more discussion about this. And I wanna invite those of you out there who are listening to participate in this discussion. You can do so by calling in. You can call the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599. You can call the UK number, which is 020-8133-6629. You can call us or instant message us on Skype. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. So we're going to come back in just a moment and continue this discussion on this growing anti-Muslim sentiment across the U.S. So stick with us here on Africa Live on UhuruRadio.com.
You're listening to UhuruRadio.com, voice of the international African revolution.
Set sail with the Uhuru Movement and the African People's Socialist Party on December 12th through 18th for a 7-day cruise to Key West, Grand Cayman, and Ocho Rios, Jamaica, aboard the luxurious Carnival Freedom cruise ship. Special guests include our very own Chairman Omali Eshetela, leader of the Uhuru Movement, and the very talented Ron Bob Simple, creator of The Spirit of Marcus Garvey, a one-man show in which Simple delivers an uncanny exactness of the legendary Garvey, transporting the onlooker back to the time of the revolutionary spirit that gave birth to the African Socialist International. Cabin prices are from $519 per person. Double occupancy and deposits start as low as $50 today, $250 by July 12th. For more information, please visit our website at uhurulegacycruise.com. That's uhurulegacycruise.com. Book your room today with Tanya's Travel by calling 352-232-2131 or by email at tanyastravel@bellsouth.net. We hope you all can set sail with us on the ship named for our struggle, freedom. Uhuru.
Rasta said, guidance forever, but backwards did it different. Rasta said, guidance everlasting, but backwards did it different.
Yeah.
Uhuru, and welcome back to Africa Live here on UhuruRadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and we've been talking about the anti-Muslim sentiment that's been growing across the U.S. We were talking about this lightning rod in New York where the proposed building of his Islamic Cultural Center has launched a serious kind of anti-Muslim rampage, you might call it, all across the U.S. And we see the stabbing of a Muslim taxi driver in New York. We see attacks on mosques all over the U.S., including in Tennessee and Arizona, California. You know, it's an interesting kind of thing. In the midst of this, you also have this recent march on Washington that was held on August 28th. Now, this march on Washington was something held and featured forces like Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin, and you know, just real anti-African, anti-Arab, you know, national, white nationalist radio and TV hosts and politicians, you know, who put this thing together. And here's the thing. This march was set on the anniversary of the March on Washington in the 1960s that featured King's I Have a Dream speech, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial where King made that speech. You know, so there is no way that anybody can look at this thing and say, and here's the thing, this is called again by these white nationalist forces who have been drumming up these you know, these white nationalist lynch mobs all across the U.S. You know, and so they do this thing on the anniversary of the March on Washington, August 28th. And so there is no way anybody can look at this and say that this is anything other than a blatant attack on African people, a blatant attack on the history of the African of the African struggle here within the U.S. This, like I said, this is hailed by some of the most vocal, rabid anti-African forces today. You know, you got Glenn Beck, who makes a living, you know, from drumming up anti-African, anti-Muslim sentiments. This guy's got a show. You know, that's what he does. That's how he makes his money, you know, by doing that. You know, then you got Sarah Palin, you know, who had only recently defended another anti-African radio host, Laura Schlesinger, when, you know, backlash, she got hit by backlash after on her radio show, you know, calling out nigga, you know, and Sarah Palin comes out, defending her right. And not just that, Laura Schlesinger, when she did that, speaking to an African caller, an African woman who called, and was raising concern about the fact that her white husband, his friends would be making nigger jokes around her, would be using the term nigger around her. And and Schlesinger's response to that African woman was to say, well, nigger, you know. She said that she was basically defending the right for white folks to call Africans nigger. And then, you know, after the backlash happened and Schlesinger decides not to be on the radio because she wants to not be challenged in her right to call African people niggers, Sarah Palin comes out in response and defends Laura Schlesinger's right, her democratic right to call African people niggers. You know, and so these are some of the forces that were at this march, you know. And then they parade out King's niece, which is not really much of a surprise to me, because they can always find they always find some Negro to justify the attacks on our people. You know, they always find some Negro. I mean, shoot, they made one president, you know, to justify the attacks on African people. And so I, you know, it's a really interesting thing, but this is part of this overall growing anti-African, anti-Muslim, non-white folks sentiment happening across the U.S. And it's happening in a response to the crisis, you know, that is being faced here, you know, in the U.S., this financial crisis, this crisis that's coming as a result of the fact that peoples around the world are, you know, challenging the ability for U.S. and European imperialism to steal their resources. And so you have this crisis You have white people not being able to live the same way they have been able to live before. And so they're looking for answers. And so there you have Glenn Beck, you know, and Sarah Palin and others like them, the Rush Limbaughs and others who you know, pointed the niggas and the Arabs and, you know, say that's your problem there. And in fact, it's a history of this anyway, you know, where white folks, when faced by crisis, come and they attack Africans in the U.S. That's how it has played out. And so one of the things that has to happen among oppressed peoples is we got to be getting organized. We got to be getting organized in our own interest to be able to get power for ourselves, to be able to defend ourselves, you know. And then also North Americans, white folks who are experiencing this crisis and want to create a different kind of situation, a different kind of world where they don't have to be, you know, a world that's not, you know, where they won't have to deal with crisis as a result of not being able to steal people's resources, need to be getting down with this movement. You know, need to be getting down with this movement to create a different kind of world where you don't have nations parasitically living off the backs of other nations of people. You know, so for everybody who wants to see a future, wants to see a different kind of world, being a part of this movement is going to be the way to make that happen. You know, that's going to be the way to make that happen. And I would call on anybody listening, Africans, North Americans, anybody who is listening to this, to really join in the struggle to create a different kind of world. Join in the struggle in solidarity with oppressed peoples who are struggling for their freedom. To support resistance, you know, to oppression, you know, that's the only way you're going to be able to create a kind of world that where you have some kind of peace that's lasting, you know. So I wanted to say those things, and we're going to take a break here, come back. We're going to play a couple of commentaries by Glenn Ford of BlackAgendaReport.com, the executive editor of BlackAgendaReport.com. And when we come back, we'll close the program out. So first we'll go into a song called La Vida by a Cuban hip-hop group, Obsession.
Con un saco, por la izquierda, un dato, no mezclar escasez con falta de honradez, eso trato, me bato, everyday, con suficiente olfato pa' no caer en desacato, a no ser que haya maltrato, 4, 5, 6, hace rato que vengo partiendo todos los acetatos, la letra diseñó, cuando hay nada boniato y arroz, pero gracias a Dios que tengo siempre algo en el plato, ato, porto y ahora mí, mosquetero yo que vivo aquí, vamos.
Cherep, 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 cherep. Shut up, shut up, shut up.
la vida. La vida.
Detrás de la fachada, donde la rutina clava su mirada.
It was perversely hilarious to observe the corporate media last week as they collectively celebrated an event that never happened. Last combat soldiers leave Baghdad, read the Washington Post headline, with variations on the same fantasy theme in Newsweek, UPI, Reuters, virtually everywhere. One had to turn to the Army Times newspaper for an accurate headline, Combat Brigades in Iraq under a different name. It is a wonderment to watch the blind enthusiasm with which the corporate media embrace name changes as if they are actual facts. As the New York Times announced the departure from Iraq of the 2nd Infantry Division's 4th Striker Brigade, describing the unit as the final U.S. combat brigade to be pulled out of the country, 7 brigades, just like the 4th Brigade, remain on Iraqi soil. There is no difference in armament, equipment, configuration, and training between the 4th Striker Brigade that exited for Kuwait and the Striker Brigades that remain behind, except the name change. The in-country Striker units are now called Advise and Assist Brigades. The 2 National Guard Infantry Brigades left behind in Iraq have also undergone a nomenclatural transformation. They are no longer combat units, but security forces. There are also 4,500 special forces in Iraq who are prepared to train other soldiers in the daytime and kill all night long. Army Times readers are primarily military people, their families, and retirees, folks that know a little something about the U.S. military and have a strong interest in learning the plain truth about the realities of U.S. deployments in the world. The Army Times appears to respect their intelligence. The New York Times and its sister publications, on the other hand, seem to think that their readers will believe anything, no matter how ridiculous on its face. For example, the Times has adopted the new practice of calling U.S. bases in Iraq fortified compounds. Combat soldiers, you see, live on bases. Personnel involved in advising and assisting Iraqis live in fortified compounds. In addition to the fantasy reporting, American military and civilian authorities are conducting fantasy arguments behind closed doors about whether the U.S. is going to withdraw all of its military forces, regardless of the nomenclature, by the end of 2011, as required by solemn agreement with the Iraqis. One faction favors deploying a force of up to 10,000 mercenaries, complete with their own armored trucks, air force, and missile-firing drones. But powerful figures in the Obama administration say they are confident they can talk the Iraqis into allowing 10,000 uniformed American troops to stay in the country after the deadline. Certainly, billions of dollars in bribes can sometimes work wonders. But U.S. plans for an eternity in Iraq have repeatedly been thwarted by the Iraqi people themselves. One thing is perfectly clear. The United States is an empire that has never voluntarily withdrawn from any of its bases or fortified compounds. The Americans are playing word games. They will leave Iraq only when they are forced to do so. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
In July of last year, Amnesty International released a report documenting the vast environmental and human rights degradations imposed on the people of the Niger River Delta by 50 years of oil exploration and production. Amnesty International sent a letter to Peter Voser, the newly appointed CEO of Royal Dutch Shell, the dominant company in the Delta oil fields, asking him to come clean on the failures and poor practice of both Shell and the Nigerian government. A little over a year later, Royal Dutch Shell and the Nigerian government have presented their answer in the form of a monstrous whitewash produced in collusion with an agency of the United Nations. The United Nations Environmental Program study, which was paid for by Shell Oil, rewrites history to blame 90% of the region's pollution on spills caused by local people tapping into oil pipelines and from sabotage by guerrilla groups. The United Nations agency admits that it only studied 300 petroleum spill sites on a list that was given to it by Shell Oil and vouched for by Shell's partners in the Nigerian government. The true scope of Niger River Delta pollution is catastrophic, with the equivalent of 9 to 13 million barrels of oil fouling the waterways, farmlands, and mangrove forests of Africa's largest wetland. That's at least twice as much oil as escaped in the recent Gulf of Mexico disaster, thus ranking Nigeria and Shell as the number one oil polluters in the world. Now the two super polluters try to blame the people for their own half century of crimes. The UN agency is now backtracking, claiming its study is not yet done and there will be no report until early next year. The figures used in the study, the UN says, are the responsibility of the Nigerian government and Shell Oil. And if that is the case, then the study has no credibility whatsoever. 27 years ago, the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation itself noted the slow poisoning of the waters and the destruction of vegetation and agricultural land by oil spills which occur during petroleum operations. The 1983 report declared that since the inception of the oil industry in Nigeria more than 25 years ago, there has been no concerned and effective effort on the part of the government, let alone the oil operators, to control environmental problems associated with the industry. Thus, 27 years ago, the oil companies and the government had already been committing environmental crimes against the people of the Niger River Delta for a quarter of a century. It is commonly accepted that oil tapping by local people and guerrilla sabotage are relatively recent phenomena. Shell Oil and the Nigerian government have no shame. Delta residents fear the UN report will be used as an excuse for stepped-up Nigerian government military operations in the region. There is also good reason to worry that the United States might seize on the UN report to add an environmental justification for its expanding military activities in West Africa. The United Nations, once the hope of the planet, has in this instance attempted to facilitate a corporate government cover-up of monumental dimensions. But the evidence cannot be hidden. It oozes from every nook and cranny of the Niger River Delta, and the people know how it got there. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Uhuru. You're listening to Organizing 101 here on uhururadio.com with Omawale K. Fing and myself, Nyabinga Zimbabwe. We're going to continue the discussion that began on last week around the question of organizing. And on last week, we gave you a bit of an overview of what organizing is, who the organizer is. And this week, we want to take a look at some examples of organizing and how the organizing work played out, in particular around the Desi Woods campaign. Yesterday marked the anniversary of the national mobilization to free Desi Woods that was held in Atlanta, Georgia. And so we want to use that case, which was an extremely important case for the Black Power movement, in looking at the question of organizing. So first of all, Comrade Omawale K. Fing is going to give us a bit of an overview of the Desi Woods case.
Uhuru, Comrade Binga and Uhuru radio listeners. Yeah, and as always, thanks for bringing me onto the program. I feel like I'm compelled to share these organizational skills that I have in that the African People's Socialist Party trained me to do, to mobilize our people for liberation. Yeah, I think you're correct. On last week, we did talk about what was the organizer. You know, we talked about the political education aspect of organizing. So on this week, what we want to do is give talk about specific instance where the party organized and actually had organizers on the ground. You know, and this on the day we want to talk about how we build a local work for the Desi Woods case, how we use the case to try to advance the overall struggle of African people for liberation, and we want to talk about the question of resources. You know, how the organizations that are concerned, who are the players, the prevailing dynamics, tactics, and strategies, and just a general view of what it takes to organize. Let me tell you first something about the Desi Woods case. As Desi Woods was an African woman who, in 1975, when it was practically unheard of for an African to kill a white person for any reason whatsoever, and that got anything less than the death penalty. In fact, it was pretty much common law that you did not defend yourself, just whatever the circumstances were, if being attacked by a white or North American people. Desi Woods defied that common law and American tradition. Her and a friend of hers were hitchhiking from a prison in South Georgia, and, you know, all of African people are pretty much familiar with the prison system one way or the other. Either we in there ourselves, or we got a sister, brother, cousin who's locked down. But anyway, Desi Woods and Cheryl Todd were coming from a prison down in South Georgia and ran into a white man who picked them up and in the process attempted to rape the two women, Desi, at gunpoint. Desi wrestled a gun from on, shot him twice in the head, and as a result, was captured and put on trial in a small town called Hawkinsville, Georgia, a town in 1975 that had its own plantation, its own prison on the plantation. Now, that was the kind of relationship African people had to white power at that time. So those were the circumstances that the party had to go into down in South Georgia and organize around Dez's case. First of all, let me just give an idea of where we were coming from in 1975. This was 1975 was a period immediately following the defeat, the military defeat, should I say, of the African Liberation Movement within current U.S. borders. It was a period that saw the destruction of the Black Panther Party and all other organizations that were raising the question of black power and were organizing on the ground to achieve black power. So as a result of the assault on the movement and our legitimate organizations, what we saw was a massive influx on our community of all sorts and manners, from white left organizations to actual black NGOs who were operating inside our community, to in fact our people having followed Jim Jones over to Guyana in 1979 as a result of the vacuum that was created when the African Liberation Movement was smashed. So here we are in 75, left virtually alone, no resources, having to contend with a white left who had become the real revolutionaries after Sundiata Herman Bell and other members of the Black Liberation Army and Black Panther Party were forced underground and were now, some of them in prisons that we had to struggle against. And at that time, also, we were, just attempting to pull ourselves back together. But the case of Dez Woods represented a real case in point in terms of the colonial violence against African people inside the U.S. Because right prior to Dez's case, there was a sister in North Carolina, I believe, Joanne Lill, who had killed her white jailer attacker, and whom the white left, and particularly the feminist movement, really came out in support of the sister. I think Ben Chavis, who was formerly from that, he, I think, joined the Communist Party of USA, I think so, and following that, the Nation of Islam. Anyway, I think it was a CPUSA-led endeavor. But this case talked specifically about women having the right to all women having the right to defend themselves, and since did not have anything to do with Joanne being an African and her attacker being white, then that should not even be a question. All questions of being African, being black in the U.S. had been liquidated or being trying to be liquidated by our white left that had descended upon our community in the absence of African liberation. This was the context in which we saw ourselves organizing in. No resources whatsoever. So we had, the African People's Socialist Party had initially began to organize in Atlanta based on the case of Pitts and Lee, two Africans who had faced the death penalty there in the state of Florida. And soon after that, with the organization efforts to move upward toward Georgia, the party introduced themselves into Atlanta, and right after that, The Desert Woods incident happened, and the party was in place, to raise serious struggle into having to fight to win back the right of African people to organize ourselves in our own interests with our own organizations. And initially, all sorts, all manner of people and organizations came in to do this work around Desi Woods, but only based on the fact that the line of white people of the white left should run this thing. But what it did, it took an organizational effort on the ground every day with common everyday African working people based right there in Vine City in Atlanta, Georgia, to raise the struggle, raise the question of, no, this is a question of colonial violence against the whole African community. And when Desi fought back, she in effect was fighting back for every African, not just in the U.S., but on the planet. And that's the way that this struggle had to be raised. And this is the way that the struggle was raised. And as a result, we ended up having to go into these small Georgia towns where the trial was being held, as I said earlier, where prisons were still on the plantations and the bosses had these things and the Klan was open organization. But we went, nevertheless. And, I think I mentioned something about demographics. One of the first things we had to do was see, where it was that we were going, what was the, racial makeup of these small towns. And what was the legacy of oppression there? Who was, the bosses, whatever. You have to make these kind of analysis before you go into town. So we actually went in, with the understanding of what forces were there, the communities, the African communities. We lived with the people and actually mobilized those African communities right there on to defend and, support their rules. This is pretty much how that struggle was made. Just let me go back to the question of, the local organizations, how this come about, and the question of resources. As I said earlier, there were no resources other than those, simple things like fish fries and selling dinners that would, generate enough money for your leases, for your flies, or whatever, for your organizers to travel, and to eat, and to be housed, that your local people take on these kind of tasks. And what made the effort in Atlanta successful in terms of the local work was precisely because the party was entrenched in that community there in terms of the people who did the work were actual working class people from that community. Let me give you an example. Like, there were, plenty, merchants in the community, just as there are merchants in our communities today who do nothing but come in, get the money, take the money out, put nothing back into the community. Now, in Atlanta, that was in Vine City, that was it was one grocer, because we felt like we should not have to buy anything if we want to have a fish fried, and they sold enough fish. They had salt, couple in our grocery stores. They had the paper plates. They had everything that we needed to do a fish fry. And so therefore, they had to donate every single thing that we needed for the fish fry. What we do, we put down the different stores in our communities. We would detail out what we needed for a particular fundraiser, and each one of these grocers would have to contribute. On one instance, that was a grocer right in the heart of Vine City named Cotner, white merchant. This guy actually refused to contribute because he had lived right across the street. I mean, his store, rather, was directly across the street from the projects in Vine City, and he had been there maybe 30 years or so, and he gave credit and he did the whole nine yards, and he thought that based on this and based on the relationship he thought he had with the elderly people who had been in those projects for all those years, that he could defy the Vine City Defense Committee, which was the name of the organization that first came up. He could defy that committee of those resources. But what he didn't know is that the very same people who were demanding these resources were those elderly people's grandsons and children. When we put up the first picket line, we say, no, this ain't going to work. Cotner, you will have to contribute. And, all we had to do was just put up, one picket sign, and no one, not a single person, went into Cotner's grocery store. And the next day, Cotner not only want to provide the food we were asking for, but Cotner wanted to donate some money to the effort too, and wanted to come speak to a community meeting, saying that, hey, they just didn't tell me what was happening right. I would have donated, it was just basic community organizing and just taking a stance, real militant kind of people, and people had worked from day one, because we knew what the defense of Desi Woods Committee had come up under similar circumstances, where a young man named Ricky Boyd had been the police had just gave him a drug case, like they do right now. That's the beginning of the implementation of the drug war in the community, the so-called war on drugs, when they begin to send people to the penitentiary for this. The Vine City Defense Committee was a part of the effort to free him, so that just transformed and went into this Desi work and was able to do some good work on that. I'm going to stop here, Bing, and see if you want to add some discussion into that or any more particulars that I should talk about.
Well, I want to first of all invite the listeners to participate in the discussion. You can call in, or you can email in. You can call the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599. You can call the UK number, which is 020-8133-6629. You can call or instant message us through Skype. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and it's all one word, all lowercase. Or you can email us at dj@uhururadio.com. So, K-Fing, when an organizer takes into consideration... what is the overall view that an organizer has to have when taking into consideration, when taking on the mission of organizing for African liberation? In this case, what, like in the Desi Woods case, what kind of overall view did y'all have to have in that and in general?
Well, see, like if we didn't have the strategic objectives and strategy that the party had put together, then those forces in the white left would have easily co-opted that movement, and right now we would still be struggling for the right of African people to have independent organization, and because we went into this struggle with the express purpose of winning African people to the position of independence. You can't forget now the question of integration was high on the agenda, not just with the civil rights politics, but with the so-called revolutionary politics, you know. So, you know, after the Black Power movement was put down, then, you know, as I said, you know, all kind of vultures, and we used to call them the ideological imperialists. We deemed them that and Ku Klux Communists, you know, because that is exactly the way that they acted. But anyway, I think, you know, like, you know, I mentioned earlier, the question of resources, the question of well, you know, we got to look at the population that we're dealing with and the geography, location. So, so we'll know, are we going into the snow? Are we going into the swamps, you know, so that's really geography and population makeup. We have to know what kind of organizations are in place in terms of, you know, like I said, you know, certain ideological imperialist organizations that you're going to have to fight off, whether the NAACP is in place there and trying to win some more concessions so its organization can get more resources. You know, is it possible for us to be a coalition type relationships or alliances? You know, and just how do we maneuver around everything, all the obstacles that's in our path mm-hmm. at organizing? Because trust me, they're going to be there. And we've got to know how to, you know, when do we compromise, when do we not? You know, just make a scientific analysis of every question that you think, you know, you're going to have to confront, you know, when you're doing the organizational work. You know, how, you know, and it just looked like the question of political repression is back on the agenda with the conviction of Diop on obviously trumped up charges, you know, Diop Olubola, who was charged with assaulting a cop in Philadelphia when it was quite obvious that Diop was the one who was assaulted. But my point here being is that that question is back on the agenda, which was a real question that we were dealing with in the early mid, you know, in the 70s. But we see that Diop is the new political president now. So in order to take organization that's talking Black Power off the street, so that assessment has got to be made, you know, what kind of legal forces, you know, that it is that we're having to deal with. So what you try to do is just make an overall assessment and look at the type of struggle you were involved in. In the case of Desi, you know, it was a question of colonial violence against our people and whether or not we as African people had the right, you know, to defend ourselves against colonial violence. I think that's the same question Diop raised, that he was raising, that he is raising, in terms of do we have a right to resist? Because, you know, what he was talking about is the police in Philadelphia, you know, and killed some 38 Africans in less than a 2-year span. And there's an African mayor there who's attempting to give the police more money to build prisons, courts, and to shoot, you know, to shoot us down. So do we have a right to resist that? So those kind of questions got to be addressed when you're looking at the overall organizational aspect. And again, you know, like I say, we you know, these things take resources, but the resources we've got to be creative on these resources. And just back to the September 4th date. This September 4th date is important because of for the first time since the defeat of the Black Revolution in the 60s, September 4th, 1977, the party was able to pull together a national mobilization in Atlanta, Georgia, which saw some 500 people come from, you know, all aspects of the movement, but right there in Bryan City itself, all, you know, the entire spectrum of the Black Liberation Movement came to Atlanta, and we reasserted at that demonstration our right to independent organization. And this was 77. I think we had talked earlier on, maybe a week or so after that demonstration, Steve Biko was assassinated and occupied as angry for raising the same similar questions. So it was really bringing African internationalism home, and the question of colonial violence was being put out there, and everybody understood it. So,
and you know, one of the things you mentioned earlier was the situation with the shop owner there in Georgia, mm-hmm. when you're organizing there and it's opposition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how what should be learned from that? You know, in terms of how we deal with opposition inside of our community to our organizing efforts, because as you said before, there'll be cases of other forces. I mean, they're like, you know, oftentimes, you know, preachers and other forces, you know, from the African petty bourgeoisie oppose, you know, our organizing efforts. So what should be learned from that particular case in terms of how to deal with opposition inside of the African community?
Well, listen, what we did with Cardinal, we knew that that these comrades who were up in our organization, that they come from them projects right there, that their mamas and grandmamas had been shopping with Cardinal for years, right? Mm-hmm. So if we would have just went out in front of Cardinal store and put up a picket line, we would have got smashed on by them African women, right?
Mm-hmm.
So first job we did was we held a series of meetings right there in the project. That all, you know, people brought their families, and we laid out the exploitation that was going down in our community from all of the merchants, you know, and, you know, educate, you know, that gave us the perfect opportunity to lay out the economics of our community and the colonial relationship that we not only have to big imperialism, but to that everybody sucks the blood of African people, you know. And by the time we got through educating our community on Cardinal, he's lucky them African women didn't come and get him themselves, you know. So that's where, you know, and I mean, see this guy, and I know it's true right today, this guy, he's got a tape on his cash register machine that's always out of ink, you know, that he's got to write down the number of what people owe him, you know, and you can systematically show where this guy has been cheating. You can take his prices and compare them with if they had the ability to go to a bigger market, you know. See, you got to do all this homework, and by this, you can, you know, pretty much, you know, I think the chairman says it all the time, you can make them write Soul Brother on the wall, you know, because, you know, and as a result, you know, these guys, once they see that the community is not going to stamp any more exploitation, next thing they want to do is sell out and get the hell up out of there, you know. So I think that, you know, anytime that our local organization that reorganized from the ground up, that basic, simple fundraisers as we build as we build solid, solid economic development, these fundraisers are going to have to be a part of our effort, and everything, all of the resources we need is right here in our community, especially from the slumlord merchants and even the slumlord landlords, buildings for offices, because we need an actual physical structure that the people can identify with and come to with their problems and for, you know, to resolve those issues. So that's what we need.
We have a email that's come in. This email says, Uhuru, good to hear the comrade explain that we do not organize just for the sake of organizing. We must remember that Barack Hussein Obama claims to have been a community organizer and used that as his credential for running for president. We are organizing for revolution, for the overthrow of white power colonialism over our lives in the U.S. and worldwide. Because of this, all our organizing work, whatever the immediate issue, is tied to building the confidence, organization, and ideological and political capacity of our people for achievement of this long-term goal.
Oh, that's well said. That's, yeah, well said. And listen, comrade, these ideas that we put forward in the community as we organize are simple, and that nothing complex about it, you know, when the people know that they need power to solve every problem that we have. You know, I mean, that, you know, as I say, our biggest stumbling block, is well, in a sense, the miseducation that we've been led to believe, you know, to believe that we got a stake somehow in this foul government. I think I listened to a presentation this morning on your show, and this was Omali Chatella speak, and where he was putting forward that we've been made to believe that Africa can't solve our problem on the one hand, but Europeans use Africa to solve every problem that it had then and that it has now. It uses Africa and African people. So my point here being is that our own resources and looking toward Africa and see what it is that we've got, you know, that we can build, we can build the confidence in the people that we can win this thing. And, you know, it's just amazing when, you know, I think last week we talked about peer pressure, you know, and you know, in the 60s, it was the peer pressure was to be a revolutionary. You know, you couldn't get by with being I'm a Martin Luther Kingite or something like that, you know, but actually the revolution, you know, you had to talk it, you know, you had to be black and I'm proud, you know what I mean? James Brown just didn't volunteer to come out of his process, you know, in funny looking suits. The black revolution did that, you know. Had James Brown talking about, I'm black and I'm proud, and get rid of you mother for the big payback. And I think we mentioned last week about Sammy Davis Jr. on the Canadian border with a powder blue turtleneck shirt, black leather jacket, and a pistol, you know, and a tam. So that's you know, it's a concept, you know, that that once that drops the brains of the masses, will become a material force, and we've seen it before. And we'll see it again. That's why, you know, now we don't organize. And I'm glad that the writer of the last of the email that came in pointed that out, that we don't organize just for organization's sake. You know, therefore, that would make us no different than any other, than an NGO. You know, we see it all the time that, you know, that we just organizing this and we organizing that. But no strategic direction toward the revolution to overturn this whole thing. Just want to mention that, and we've got to come back to these kind of basics. Like we talked about, Chairman, weekend and how labor cannot be respected until the African is paid for the work that we've done. I think that, this September 4th, 1977 mobilization we're talking about was actually nothing new for the party, because on every holiday that the bourgeoisie afforded, we used that time to organize our people, or whether it was in the mass demonstration or rally somewhere, or whether it was used for 3 days of intensive political education. Things like September 4th was actually used when our people get a break from, you know, from the toil and sweaty work in the factories, and give us a day off. We would actually use that time to mobilize our forces and to teach, to organize, instead of, you know, just bringing out the barbecue pits. We use that time really effectively, and I think that we're going to have to get back to that, you know, because a year following that September 4th mobilization, we used the 4th of July weekend to organize a national mobilization to Plains, Georgia. This was where Jimmy Carter's hometown was, and this is at a time when, well, actually, Carter came to power as a born-again Christian, because I guess the entire U.S. population hadn't lost confidence in white power, but they had lost confidence in the government, you know, with Richard Nixon having to declare publicly that he wasn't a crook, you know. So then Carter comes in as the Christian, but at the same time, we can show here Africans in this, you know, in his hometown, peanut farmer, you know, plantation town, saying, mm-hmm. "Hey, I think that the similar thing that's happening right here today, show you how the party is on, you know, is got the trajectory correct. The same thing will be happening on November 13th in Washington, D.C., in the form of the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparation, who will be going to Washington, D.C., just as the party went to Plains, Georgia in 1978, but we'll be going in coalition form this time to Washington, D.C., to expose, just like we exposed Jimmy Carter, expose Barack Obama as an agent of imperialism. So, again, you know, all our organizational work must be tied to the revolution as the party. You know, we just don't organize for organization's sake. So I think that, you know, the effort to get to D.C. with the Black Is Back Coalition is a part of that effort, and it's a continuation of what we did in 1978 in terms of, you know, Black Is Back.
Now we have a caller. Caller, you're on there.
Hello, brother.
brother Sidney, how are you?
Hello, my good brother. I'm calling from the United Kingdom, and I was just listening to my good brother Omawale Kefing speaking about some of the problems we have, we as black people, in terms of organizing. And I just wanted to ask my brother if he believes that some of our problems could be relieved by organizations such as yourselves, i.e. the Uhuru movement, simplifying your approach. Or basically what I'm talking about here is an issue I have spoken about in the past. I'm referring to the multifaceted nature of the organization. within the Uhuru movement, you have the ABDEP, ASI, the which other ones? IMPIDOM. Do you not think, my dear brother, that such a multitude of organizations can be confusing to the average Joe Blogs, John Doe out there, who will not understand why there are so many organizations, why he's been bombarded with so many different facets of the same movement? Do you not think that your work could be simplified by A, keeping those organizations from view, in other words, making it a private private entities, things that you would know about but which would not necessarily be exposed to the public?
Okay.
Do you understand my question, or shall I rephrase it?
Yeah. I think I understand the question. Let me say this. I think at the beginning of this discussion, we talked about organizing the local base. Now, for instance, here in Houston, there is a local ABDEP, and what that local ABDEP did was that it built a community garden that produced hundreds and hundreds of pounds of fresh vegetables to be dispersed in the community, which happened. Now, the people love their organization, ABDEP, right? They do garden work. So this is what they do. But in the meanwhile, while they're doing this garden work, there's nothing to keep us from having political education on the whole problem that's African people. And trust me, people have the ability to learn that. That's not to say, hey, we're going to take these people who are in ABDEP and put them in NPDOM or put them in ASI, but build dual and contending powers for every question that's confronting us. Now, in terms of simplicity, our mission is to set the local organizations on the ground. Local organizations will obviously deal with local problems. Then why did the police shoot John Ugabuga? You know, I mean, why did Sister Sarah get evicted from her home with her children on the street? You know, that is the question. That is what local organization will do, and struggle in their own selfish interest at the moment. What's happening in their lives right then? Our mission is to educate people to why, you know, that you can't separate no housing from the police shooting somebody when it's just peculiar to African people or in Texas to Mexican people, you know. So I think that as we organize for one, you know, on one question, that what we do, we educate and show the people that none of this stuff is isolated, but you know, I don't think we would ask people to come in and join all these different organizations at one time. Even that's why when you go to the WHO movement site, you will see that each organization has a site. So if a person is interested in any particular kind of work, then they have the ability to get involved, you know. So, but now that's my perspective on the one hand. But on the other hand, we want to simplify this process, and we welcome all who's going to help us to do this. You know, obviously, and I think Chairman talked about this morning, that we don't got the blueprint as such. No, but we do have an overall strategic trajectory that, in our opinion, is correct all on the line. But that does not mean that we don't need no help to simplify or clarify a better way to do it. So we invite all of that, and hopefully that helped clarify and answer the question.
With great respect, my dear brother, as you know, Brother Mowale, I have the greatest respect for you personally and for the Uhuru movement. Actually, I admire you guys very much. I will say this any day of the week, and you can quote me. My name is Olufemi Jabode, okay? I admire you, the Uhuru people, the Uhuru movement. I admire you because I like your analysis of the problems confronting us, and I like you for your boldness in stating what the issues are. However, with respect to this question of the multiplicity of identities and organizations, I think that will be a major problem for you. And I say that because it gives the multiplicity of organizations gives the impression that A, you are not organized or prepared, B, that you are fragmented, that the Uhuru movement is a fragmented, confused and confusing body. Now, I'm sure there are many of your listeners out there who will want to make a contribution to help that. And I will call on them, as I will be doing, to make suggestions as to how you can overcome that problem. I still don't understand why the Uhuru movement cannot undertake the work of these subsidiary organizations in its own name, in its own identity. What's preventing the Uhuru movement from doing the work of the IMPEDOM or ASI or ABDEP?
Well, if I may, Femi, the Uhuru movement is all of these things. And each of these organizations have different things that they are able to take on. Not all of them can take on everything. For instance, the African People's Socialist Party, which is an African revolutionary organization, would not take on the same work as the African People's Solidarity Committee, which is an organization, a cadre organization of North Americans or white people whose work is based in the white community. You know, there are different organizations that take on different pieces of work, have different focuses, and all of these are part of the Uhuru movement. The Uhuru movement is, as a movement, is a larger thing. Just as, it's a larger
an umbrella organization.
Well, it's you wouldn't. I don't even know if you necessarily call the Uhuru movement in general as an organization, but you have various organizations that are part of this movement together, and so. But they have different aims. They have different. They have different particular objectives. Each organization and different focuses, different expertises as well. You know, so it serves us to have different organizations that carry out different things, just like many corporations oftentimes have different organizations that do carry out different objectives, and so I haven't experienced people in general, you know, feeling that they were confused or that we seemed confused to them because we had different organizations. I've on the other hand seen people amazed when they see these various organizations of the Uhuru movement in action in these different facets, in these different areas of work. I think, you know, we may have to deal with the question of how, you know, explaining to folk the different organizations. And part of the thing that's helpful in having these different organizations is that it allows for people who come to us for various different kinds of reasons to be able to be a part of this movement. There are people who may be able to be in MPDUM who can't be in a cadre organization. MPDUM, which is a mass organization, can't be. There are people who will be in that who can't be in the African People's Socialist Party because the African People's Socialist Party is a cadre organization that requires a greater kind of discipline, you know. And so we have different organizations that make it possible for people to participate where they come in, you know, in their different, you know, ways. And I think that's one of the things that is important, you know, in the Uhuru movement, that allows, you know, for a broad kind of participation.
And another thing about that, Binga, is that the comrade is raising as difficult as it might be, problem that this organization has got room to come in and struggle with what you think is right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think, you know, that instead of saying, well, you've got this problem, say, we got this problem that needs to be solved, you know, and I think that it will carry, you know what I mean? I'm recruiting, bro.
I take your points entirely, brother. And guess what? I truly feel that way. Otherwise, I wouldn't be raising it.
Okay.
It's a problem that we have because, as I keep saying, I think you guys you seem to be the most impressive organization that I have come across in terms of your ability to state the issues and to say it very boldly and very clearly for the world to hear. I don't think anyone can but respect that. However, it is my job as someone who wishes you well to point these things out so that you are aware of how or what kind of impression you are making on the initiated people out there, people who will be coming into contact with the Uhuru movement for the first time. What impressions will they have of you when they meet you? Because don't forget, like all meetings, first impressions count. If someone doesn't feel that the Uhuru movement is a credible vehicle for their hopes and aspirations in terms of achieving freedom for our people, dignity for our people, human rights for our people, if they don't feel that, within a very short time of meeting you, it's very likely that such people would peel away and go elsewhere. And we need to attract as many people as we can.
Yeah, we really don't need to recruit. Just let me say this, son. We don't have no stakes in not trying to do it better. You know, and we would be negligent as freedom fighters and revolutionaries if we tried to hold on to doing the thing the old way, when we can do it a new and better way. So, my only point here being that if it's right, we'll do it right, you know, because we don't have no stakes in being wrong, you know, and our total mission, you know, is freedom and liberation allow people, in order to do that, we know that it's going to require the destruction of U.S. and Western imperialism, you know. So all our work is geared toward that, and trust me, we welcome all innovations and what it is that we have to do and need to do. And again, we don't have no stake in being wrong.
We have a minute left. First of all, thank you, Femi, for calling in. Comrade Umwali K. Fing, is there anything you want to say in closing?
Well, yeah, you know, like, just want to say that, we've got to organize because our enemies keep us oppressed precisely because we are not organized. And I would want to call on the whole radio listening audience to check out the November 13th demonstration and rally that's happening in Washington D.C. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations sponsoring in November. And on this Labor Day, you know, we've got to point out that until African labor is respected and paid back, that this whole Labor Day thing is a farce. And I think I heard on Chairman's speech this morning that in terms of the origins of this imperialist Labor Day, I think that what the imperialists were responding to was a thing that was put forward by, I think, maybe Lenin, over there, and the workers, I think they had declared May 1st Workers Day or something like that, International Workers Day, and the bourgeoisie, of course, they despise all workers. So hopefully we will use this Labor Day, next Labor Day, and the upcoming Labor Days to press our demands for to be paid for stolen black labor.